Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present, with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Since I come here to Liverpool, to Anfield, I've drummed it into our players time and again that they are privileged to play for you. And if they didn't believe me, they believe me now.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield and tonight we are recording the second edition of our magazine series. And this time we have decided to stay on English shores and we have put together a magazine about Liverpool Football Club. Currently we stand at 160 pages, 14 long form articles about the history of and obviously two people tonight will agree with me, one probably not, and the population will be completely divided, but arguably about the most successful, dare I say it, English football club. Now, before we get into the magazine and the articles, etc., obviously I need to introduce my two co-hosts for tonight. We do have a special guest as well, who will come as no surprise once they're introduced as well. So first of all, let me introduce Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, how are you, sir?
I'm good, thank you, buddy. I'm not sure which one of the two guys are going to disagree about Liverpool being the most successful club, but, you know, I'm going to agree with that.
obviously, I've introduced you first this time, Gary. Normally, for whatever reason, it seems to be the other co-host that gets introduced first, but I think you and I might be a little bit quieter tonight while we let the other two talk.
I think that's probably true, mate, but alphabetically S comes before T anyway, so that makes perfect sense to me anyway, buddy.
Brilliant. So the second co-host, which obviously will come as no surprise, is a guy who's relatively fond of Liverpool Football Club and mentions them in passing every now and then when we get together on the podcast, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, how are you, sir?
Oh, I'm very well, thanks, Stu. Yes, you could say I've got a bit of a soft spot for this team and this topic.
Now, normally this is the point where I ask you if you're looking forward to this particular podcast.
I think I'll just give a big yes straight away.
That's all
before
right.
The question's even asked.
obviously, you know, for you, Stephen, I believe that this is currently one of the fastest selling magazines that we've done so far. I think this is the sixth club edition, went on sale at the beginning of this week as we stand. So I think Monday the 6th of January it went on sale, due for release mid-February, and orders are stacking up. But I believe the order sort of opportunity closes within the next sort of 5 or 6 days. So people have got to be quick if they want to get a copy of this one.
They've got to be quick for this one because, you know, they sell out quickly normally anyway, but this one's just gone quite stratospheric very, very quickly. So, it's going to be a small window of opportunity to get this one. So, you know, if you're tempted by it, you know, go for it. Who was it that said it before? Was it? It was Will, who came out of an absolutely brilliant kind of like summing up of it. It's either, you know, order it now or buy it for three times the price on eBay in a couple of months' time.
And obviously, once you buy them on eBay, and we talked about this with the AC Milan one, you then lose that extra incentive of the new smelling magazine as well. Because once it's second hand,
exactly.
That smell's
exactly.
Gone.
It's gone. Once it's gone, it's gone forever.
Exactly. So obviously, Stephen, you know, you would be, I would argue, you would be more than enough for this podcast, but I felt we needed to, well, I would say bring in balance, but it's brought in no balance whatsoever. But we have brought another guest in. And for those who are regular listeners...
No, this is no occasion for balance, Stu.
No. You're probably right. So this will come as no surprise, but it is a wonderful guest, and really it was probably only ever going to be one choice. And that's Mr. Jeff Goulding. Jeff, how are you, sir?
I'm very well. Good evening. Like Stephen, I have a mild passing interest in Liverpool football club.
Yeah, I've heard that. I think that's why we were just looking for people who had, you know, just people who just knew a little bits and bobs about the club, shall we say. So we thought we'd get you involved.
Yeah, I'll do my best.
Okay, so for the next, probably the best part of the next hour and 20 minutes, we're going to try and rattle through a little bit of the history of the Liverpool Football Club. We're going to discuss, obviously, the magazine. All of us have put articles in to the magazine, so we've all contributed. Stephen, I believe you've contributed two articles to this one.
Yeah, I've been greedy for this one, and I've got two in there. But no, Omar had asked. He said, "Oh, do you fancy doing two kind of like very different articles?" And I jumped at the opportunity. To do my hero, Kenny Dalglish, you know, to try and do him justice was a painstaking kind of effort, really. You know, you want to do this article and do it very well. And I hope I have. But, you know, I resoundingly went over the word count for it in doing so. But I levelled that off with kind of like undercutting my second article, which was on fan culture. It doesn't mean I've sold it any less. But I've balanced the two articles together, and yes, there's a rambling piece about Kenny Dalglish, but there's this homage to this, you know, amazing Liverpool fan culture, which, you know, is a completely different entity to anything else that goes on in English football. And, you know, I say that as a Liverpool fan, but I believe it as well. You know, there's this concept that Liverpool fans are just very, very, you know, different in their approach to supporting the football club, but also just the love of football as well. It's just very much a massive enjoyment. You know, so many people, you know, who are detractors will class it as being unbearable, and I touch on the unbearable side of it, and it is a little bit warts and all as well. You know, I do point out the downsides of the Liverpool support. It isn't just this, you know, homage to Liverpool fans at all. You know, I do point out our rough sides and the rough edges, and hopefully it's, you know, a well balanced piece that makes sense to certain fellow Liverpool fans, but also, you know, gives an insight to people who aren't Liverpool fans, but, you know, buy the magazine simply out of the love for football.
But I mean, it's good actually. I mean, fan culture is Liverpool fan culture is something that we will touch on. You know, as I always say, when you're the host, it's great because you're in charge of what people talk about. And certainly Anfield, you know, Liverpool fans, the atmosphere is certainly something, you know, that interests me. Jeff, your piece, what have you graced the magazine with?
Oh, well, I think I've been the luckiest of all, really, because I got to write about what is the most successful period in Liverpool Football Club history. So I got to write about the Bob Paisley era from 1974-75 season through to when he left in the early 80s, a period of 9 years in which he won almost everything that it was possible to win. And, you know, what I wanted to do with that, it's a little bit like Stephen's just talked about there. When you're writing about someone so iconic, someone who's been so storied and written about so extensively, it's quite a challenge to come up with something that maybe hasn't been written before. And what I really wanted to do was delve into the man with this article, to really explore his personality. There's a lot been written about Bob Paisley in terms of, you know, clearly he had an eye for a Liverpool player. Clearly he was a great tactician, but you know, people often talk about the fact that his accent was impenetrable and he wasn't the best communicator. It's long been fabled that he didn't want the job and practically had to be manhandled into taking the job. But I think there's a deeper story behind Bob Paisley, really, and I think he's got hidden depth, and I've tried to kind of cover that in this piece, and hopefully, as Stephen said, hopefully I've done that justice and maybe shone a light, in places where maybe it hasn't been explored too much before.
Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. Gary, what have you, as a Chelsea fan, what have you graced the pages of a Liverpool magazine with?
Well, I picked one of my favourite midfielders of all time, so I'm talking a lot about Frank Lampard. No, sorry, I'm sorry. I'm talking about Xabi Alonso, who, when we were discussing topics for the magazine, I was really keen to pick on Alonso because he's one of my favourite players, non-Chelsea players, but also one of my favourite type of players as well. Had that ability to maintain a calmness around him when all... calmness internally when all about him was going frantic and bored. I've got a phrase in the piece I wrote about that he was like a Velasquez portrait when everything around him is like a Jackson Pollock piece of art with their lines dashing away everywhere, but he creates beautiful pictures with his football.
Well, that sounds beautiful, Gary. I can say from a Chelsea fan about a Liverpool for a Liverpool magazine. That's pretty magnanimous of you.
No, I mean, I think all of us, you know, we have our own club allegiances, but we all like beautiful football, and, you know, there's no doubt that, I say to my mind, Xabi Alonso is sort of my kind of footballer.
It's funny, actually, the way it's just sort of dawned on me as we've been chatting these sort of first 10 minutes, and obviously I've put an article. I know, you know, Jeff, you thought you had the, you know, the best job and the best subject. I picked the 87-88 season and that Liverpool side, which for me as a non-Liverpool supporter and purely sort of as from an independent point of view, I got the opportunity to just watch essentially a season's worth of YouTube of what was for me a wonderful Liverpool side. So my job was pretty decent too, but it's strange listening to you, Stephen, and you, Jeff, as well, that I've written about a side and I've written about a club, and then all of a sudden I'm about to talk to two fans who, A, are going to know a lot more than I do about this side, and B, are going to read what I've written and almost judge it as a Liverpool fan, really, first and foremost, rather than as a friend. So I must admit, over the last the last 10 minutes, I've been put a little bit on the back foot and tried to remember what it is that I've actually written about and what it is I've said. So I suppose we'll start first of all. Gary, I'm going to come to you first. Liverpool Football Club, what does it mean to you?
I guess, you know, these sort of things come in waves, don't they? But, you know, there's no doubt in my lifetime that, you know, despite, I suppose, you know, the long success Alex Ferguson had with Manchester United over the years, you know, six European titles is pretty impressive. And, you know, I guess, you know, Liverpool are probably, you know, Man United fans will dispute this, no doubt, but they're probably the most successful team. In my lifetime, which goes back to the mid-50s. Although, obviously, for the first 10 years or so, Liverpool were a fairly mediocre team until we get on to the Shankly, as I'm sure we'll talk about afterwards. But during this sort of football formative years, you know, Liverpool were a team that just dominated English football and indeed dominated European football. And obviously, they've had this sort of massive hiatus been there since their last league title, but I've got a little inkling that's going to be put right at the tail end of this season. In fact, probably well before the tail end of this season, because they, you know, I mean, every football fan thinks their club is special, but I guess most football fans will accept that, you know, the history and the traditions of Liverpool Football Club do make them a little bit special as well.
I get what you're saying, Gary. When you look at it from an independent point of view, as we are, it's very much as outsiders looking in, and it's very much a case of it's admiration, it's respect, and it's all of those things. But like you say, it's still always the club that you support first and foremost, and it's almost a begrudging admiration in that respect. But obviously...
Yeah, I think I just think you mentioned respect. I think that's the right word, you know. And you know, if I was a Manchester United fan, I might be viewing it differently because, but you know, although my club's had a, you know, a fair lack of success, especially in the last couple of decades, you know, I still sort of, you know, can sort of nod the head to the success that you know, that Liverpool had over such a long period.
Obviously now we'll cut across to Jeff and Stephen, and bear in mind we've only got probably an hour and 15 minutes or so, guys, and we've got quite a lot to get through. But I'll come to you first, Jeff. Liverpool Football Club, you know, I suppose a slightly different question for you. Where do you think it sits on perhaps a more national, international stage?
I think that's a really interesting question. I think if you look at how we're viewed internationally, it's very different to how we're viewed by supporters in England, if I'm honest. I think internationally we have this almost mythical status, I think, which obviously goes back to the 70s and 80s, and Anfield has got this aura about it, and you see that in the European games. You see teams from fans of European clubs visiting Anfield on the big European nights, and they're posing for selfies in front of the cop, they're swapping scarves with fans outside the ground, they're filming You'll Never Walk Alone, they're applauding You'll Never Walk Alone, they're joining in sometimes, and it feels like they're almost there to admire. They almost feel like they're visiting a great, you know, tourist attraction or a cathedral or something like that. And I think we are revered on an international stage. I think it's very different, I think, to the English fans, if I'm completely honest. I have read some statistics that say that we do have a very large fan base in England, but we're amongst the sort of non-Liverpool supporting fans in English football, I think there is more of an antipathy towards Liverpool, that's kind of manifest in the kind of songs and abuse that's sung at Anfield when you know visiting teams come to Anfield. So I think it's very stark difference, really. I think true football fans, genuine football fans like yourselves, who maybe have an allegiance with a different club, do have a grudging respect for Liverpool's history and for the sort of lore of its culture and the history of the cop and so on. But if I was asked, how we viewed outside of the club, I think it is very different depending on whether it's in England or whether it's across Europe.
It's great. It's a great answer, Jeff. And I know. Before we started this podcast, I promised I was going to ask you all the same questions. But as we've established, thinking time is dangerous. So, Stephen, you're going to get a different question. In terms of how Liverpool are perceived, Jeff's made a great point. You know, fans of football will respect and will admire. You know, and Gary's given a great opening for us. Do you think there is an envy, if you like, of Liverpool Football Club? Do you think, other clubs, other supporters, it's an envy that exists, or do you think that it's more, we had this, with Manchester United when they were successful. Do you think fans particularly like to dislike successful clubs? And, this is no disrespect to Liverpool at the moment, but they've gone through a relative period when you talk about, as Jeff did earlier, the late 70s, early 80s, when they were dominating the league and Europe and up until 1990. Do you think this more sort of recent love affair with Liverpool comes from the fact that they've not won, other than two Champions Leagues, not won that much sort of in the last 20 years?
I think it works on a sliding scale. I've spoken to people, various parts of the country where I'd class it as there's a respect for Liverpool, and in certain circumstances, yes, there's an antipathy. Yes, there's, a tribalistic hatred. If you ask your Covent Garden Everton fan, that they'll spit before they say the name. And the same with Man United fans, and in a growing sense, Manchester City fans as well, which never quite used to be the case. But on the other hand, there's also kind of like an admiration. It might be a silent admiration, but it's there. And I think, a lot of people at the minute with this vintage of Liverpool admire the way they play the game. Jurgen Klopp's very difficult to dislike. as a personality. So, you know, I've even known like Man United fans say, you know, he's great, and you know, but kind of like really not wanting him to be. You know, so there's kind of like a double sided coin to it. You know, I mean, people talk about kind of like, you know, the Conservatives won general election. You know, who are these people that are voting for them? You know, I think there is a silent, you know, strand through the country that, you know, kind of have a respect for Liverpool and you know, but don't really kind of like shouter, you know. And that's one of the things that I found with this magazine kind of like selling so quick is that, you know, we did speak long and hard and discuss whether we should do it or not. Simply on the basis of that tribalistic nature, you know, is it just Liverpool fans who are going to want it? But the response seems to have been, you know, very enthusiastic, not just from Liverpool supporters. It, you know, supporters of other football clubs, of people who just love football in general are kind of like jumping on it and really enthusiastic for it, which speaks to me of an underlying respect that goes alongside the more tribalistic opposite end of the spectrum where, you know, people really dislike them. And I understand why people really dislike them. You know, it's in Liverpool and Manchester United, you know, share a lot and uncomfortably share a lot. They don't, you know, they're very, very, you know, there's a lot of similar mirror images between the two clubs and the set of supporters and the way, you know, they are viewed, which, you know, neither Liverpool or Manchester United fans want to hear, but that's just the way it is. And like I say, there is this middle ground, though. There is this massive middle ground, and it's a much more multicoloured span than people kind of realise. But Jeff is absolutely correct in the fact that, you know, across the continent, across the world, Liverpool are, you know, are loved and kind of like, you know, really respected as one of the greats of the game. You know, if you talk about European football, then yes, you know, it's Liverpool are up there with your Real Madrids and your Ajaxes and all of them, really.
I mean, before we move on, I can confirm what you're saying about the intense discussions as to whether or not we should sort of round out the series with a Liverpool magazine. It was an incredibly intense discussion amongst sort of the, you know, the These Football Time writers, and like you say, would it work, wouldn't it work, who would buy it, who wouldn't. And I think, you know, we always sort of trust Omar. You know, we always trust his decision, his gut instinct, and obviously, you know, he sort of gave it the final nod. And I think once again, as you said, he's been proved right.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, if we're you know, burning our soul there, you know, I think the fact that it was a big decision to make, and you know, but as well, there was a common sense behind it as well, and I think that was the way that I put it at the time when discussions were going on, was that, you know, here's a club who are one of the big megaliths of world football, European football, domestically, massively storied, but contemporarily, you know, the best team in the world today. You know, and you know, if this was Manchester United doing this, I would have put my hands up and said, yeah, it needs to be done. It would have been a difficult admission, and Dan did it. You know, Dan Williamson, you know, Manchester United through and through. You know, he eventually, you know, he turned around, not even eventually, but right at the very start, you know, it was a kind of like, oh, do we have to do this? But I understand why, you know. And that, for me, said it all, really, was that, you know, it was there to be done, and it just made common sense to do it.
Brilliant. Yeah, you're right. That was pretty much exactly how it went. What I'm going to do, fellas, is I'm going to sort of give you a manager each to chat about. Obviously, Jeff, I'll get you to discuss about Paisley in a minute. Stephen, I'll get you to discuss Dalgleish as the manager. I know you've written an article about him as, you know, as a person, like you've said, but certainly as the managerial side. But Gary, you know, I suppose really, you know, if we go back to the beginning and Bill Shankly. Your thought, I mean, really, that's where the Liverpool story for most football fans start. I know it doesn't just start with Bill Shankly, but that's where this success, this period where the magazine starts, comes from the appointment of Bill Shankly at Anfield.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure that's true. But I think it's not only the success, I think it's also the, you know, I think what's, you know, Stevie and Jeff would probably sort of call the culture. because Shankly, when he moved in, he created an ethos around the club. I mentioned earlier that, you know, in my sort of very young years, Liverpool were a pretty bang ordinary second division club, until Shankly arrived on the scene, got promoted in the early 60s, 61, 62, something like that. And from then, he sort of developed the club and they moved forward. They won the FA Cup. They won the Football League, the First Division, as it was called in those days, a couple of times. And he created, it's always a bit of a cliche to say, you know, somebody created the foundations upon which other people built. But I think that's, if it's true of anything, it's true of Shankly with Liverpool. You know, he was one of these managers. We talk, you know, he took over Liverpool, I suppose, it must be the late 50s or towards the turn of that decade. And we're talking here now, so 60 years later, and the guy is still revered. And when I wrote my first book, I put a quote from Shankly on the back of the book, because, you know, he came up with such a wonderful phrase to sum up the importance of football, you know, the old classic, you know, about it's not a matter of life and death, it's far more important than that. So Shankly had a wonderful effect, not only on Liverpool Football Club, but also, I think, on English football. But, you know, I'd just be interested to see what Stevie and Jeff say, but, you know, as I say, as much as for the success he brought to the club, he created the club, for the club, I think he also created the culture.
You're right, and that, you know, it's a great, you can tell we work together, Gary, all the time. It's a great link, because obviously, Jeff, you know, I'm going to get you to speak about, you know, obviously about Bob Paisley, but you've got to think about exactly what Gary's just said there. Now, had Paisley come before Shankly, and had it been the other way around, would the Liverpool story have been quite so successful?
Well, I think one of the things you can say about Paisley is he certainly didn't have the charisma. And he wasn't the great communicator. And by that, I mean, he obviously had a way of communicating, but he wouldn't have been able to communicate with the masses in the way that... I mean, there's a great piece of footage on YouTube of Shankly on the steps of St George's Hall at Lime Street, and he's almost conducting this crowd of 150,000 people. You know, he waves a hand and the crowd falls silent. And, you know, when he speaks, you can see people looking at him like he's some kind of, you know, all-conquering hero. And Paisley didn't have that, not in the way of communicating with the masses. I think Gary's right. I mean, certainly Shankly, it's undeniable that he created the foundations for the future success. I mean, I think I did a... I looked at how many trophies we'd won. I think we've won 47 trophies, and 39 of those came after Shankly arrived. So, you know, he did revolutionise the club, and he was ahead of his time in many ways. But I actually think one of the biggest and one of the best decisions Shankly made when he arrived at Liverpool was to keep the boot room intact. So he didn't get rid of Fagan, he didn't get rid of Ruben Bennett, he didn't get rid of Bob Paisley, he didn't get rid of, you know, he promoted people like Ronnie Moran into the boot room. And he valued loyalty, and he knew that what he had at Liverpool were people who'd been at Liverpool for a long time, who understood the club inside out. And also they possessed qualities that he didn't have. So interestingly, you know, many of the players viewed Paisley as Shankly's henchman. You know, he would deliver the bad news, and so on. So to answer your question, I suppose no. I suppose if Paisley had come first, then we wouldn't have seen that. And certainly, Paisley learned a lot from working under Shankly. But also, one of the things that came through, and I hope I've got it through in the article I've written, is that actually he's a very complex character. There's lots of layers there, and what appears on the surface is not necessarily, you know, what was going on inside with Bob Paisley. He had a great ability, I call it an emotional intelligence, a great ability to understand what motivates people. And you know, there's some great stories from In St. John about how he was a master at manipulating Bill Shankly. So if a player was injured, you couldn't say you were injured because Shankly would just disown you. But Paisley would tell the player to pretend he was fit and then run around the dressing room, and Shankly would look at him and go, "No, son, you can't play." You know, and it was Paisley who would tell the players you know, how to handle Shankly and how to get around Shankly. He obviously knew, you know, he knew people very, very well. And I think that was his great gift, to be honest with you. I think he could see in a player in an opposing team, he could see a weakness in that player. And if he was, you know, if he was looking at a potential signing, you know, he would know exactly what their strengths and weaknesses were, what they could add to the team. And he knew what type of player he could work with as well. So it was no good him, you know, filling the team with lots of people who needed tons of guidance and tons of advice all of the time. He needed leaders in the team, people who could think for themselves, particularly on the pitch. Kind of the whole Liverpool boot room frowned on any player who asked for, you know, what should we do now, boss? You know, the answer would frequently come back, we've paid all this money for you, why are you asking us what to do? You should know yourself. So I think Paisley, you know, Paisley took what Shankly had created, but the great thing about Paisley, the absolute magic of Bob Paisley is that he made it better. And, you know, to put that into context, you know, look at how other teams have struggled to replace a great manager down the years. And you probably can't think of very many clubs who've replaced someone of the stature of Bill Shankly and gone on to even better things afterwards. So, you know, I for me, you know, it's very close call between the two. And it depends what time of day you ask me, really, whether Shankly's the greatest manager or whether it's Paisley.
It's great. I find Bob Paisley, you know, fascinating. I mean, I didn't have an interest in football when Shankly was there, but certainly my formative football years and Liverpool Football Club was all through Bob Paisley. And I suppose, Jeff, it's fascinating when, you know, Gary mentioned about how this culture was established through Shankly, and you've mentioned there that Paisley improved, and there were such completely different characters that I still, as an outsider looking in, struggle to see how he maintained the culture, improved the success rate, and yet was a completely different personality. And yet the football almost just seemed seamless, and yet you had two completely different characters at the helm.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is the question. And I think for me, it is. And so Shankly, for me, be interesting to know what Steve thinks, but Shankly, for me, was sheer force of personality. You know, the amount of players that you listen to giving, ex-players giving interviews, you say, you know, if Shankly told you something, you just believed him. If Shankly said, you know, this would happen, then that was going to happen and that was the end of it, you know. Shankly was all about charisma. He was all about, you know, him, the personality, and the effect that he had on the people around him. And he made them believe that they were better than they were. Whereas Paisley had to go about it in a completely different way because he didn't possess those characteristics. Paisley had to play a different game, really. So Paisley was very good at understanding people. He was very good at, as I say, he's very good at, you can use manipulating as a strong word, but he was very good at getting people onto, you know, his way of thinking. He also had, you know, a cutting wit as well. And, you know, people liked him and people wanted to play for him. I mean, there's a great story about when he was given the job and he presents himself in the dressing room and he tells them, Steve Highway says he told us 8 times he didn't want the job. But after the team meeting, when Paisley leaves the room, the players all say, look, we've got to do this for Bob. If we don't work for him, we don't help him out, this is not going to work. And there's some people who would argue that that was quite a deliberate ploy by Bob Paisley, because he didn't want the players to think that he'd been a suitor for Shankly's job, Shankly in the back, that he'd been, you know, ambitious. And you know, whatever the reason was why he chose to go into the dressing room and tell them all he didn't want the job, it worked. It works spectacularly. They all rallied round and you know, worked together as a unit. So I think it's absolutely true. They both had completely different qualities, but they used what they had to the absolute utmost. And just one final thing on the culture thing. I think it is true that Shankly, you know, he created the kind of unbearableness of Liverpool fans, the exceptionalism of Liverpool fans. You know, we all do think we're special. I think we're special. And I know I'm irritating when I say that. but Shankly made us think that we're special. He did. He made us think that this club was unique and special. And we all still believe that that's the case today. But actually, Shankly Shankly noted something Liverpool fans, and as someone who's kind of researched on stories about Liverpool, you know, you do see this cropping up in newspaper articles pre-Shankly about the behaviour of Liverpool fans, about the difference, you know, in Liverpool fans. They tend to become louder when they're a goal down than when they're a goal up, and all of that is in the kind of archives pre-Shankly. And I think when Shankly came to Liverpool, I think he saw something he could build on. I think he saw, you know, I can work with these people. These are my kind of people. And I think he just took it to another level.
It's brilliant. And, you know, it links perfectly. And I know, you know, Stephen, we have the appointment of Joe Fagan, you know, again, successful, albeit for an incredibly short period of time. And then the next manager that we come to that continues this tradition, I suppose, you could argue is another sort of different personality when you think of Kenny Dalglish. You know, and obviously you've written about him, but again the success is sort of seamless. The improvement almost, and like I say, for me, that 87-88 side, you know, still the best Liverpool side I've seen, even in today's comparison. But yet again, another completely different character, but yet still seems to maintain and improve what he had.
Yeah, I mean, this is where it became a dynasty, and there's nothing quite like it in English football. And I think even if you look across continental football, not in a true dynastic nature. I mean, you can look at Real Madrid and being so successful for so long. Ajax, you know, Barcelona, you know, in periods more contemporary than in the past. You know, AC Milan, Juventus, they've all had these great periods of success. Yet sometimes with other clubs, it feels like a line is being drawn between the coaches. It's kind of like, and each coach is compartmentalised, whereas with Liverpool's, it just seems to roll one into the other, like a continuing, you know, running stream almost. And it eventually came to Dalglish, and, you know, it was an interesting, you know, appointment to have to make, really. You know, Dalglish, the player, was ageing. You know, there had been a point when Fagan had dropped him for a game or two in that last season that he was in charge. I can remember rumours of Newcastle being interested in taking to St James Park as a player to replace Kevin Keegan. You know, would have been the second time that would have happened as a player had that actually happened. I can remember those rumours circulating. But now Liverpool just wanted to keep hold of him in some capacity. And when Fagan resigned, which he'd intimated to the board earlier in the season, to give them enough time to formulate a plan to bring in a new manager, it came down to the kind of like looking at the backroom staff and thinking, well, Ronnie Moran would be the next in line. But he was the sergeant major of the Liverpool boot room. He wasn't, you know, viewed as being managerial potential. So it meant that either Liverpool had to look to the outside to bring someone in, or, you know, rethink their internal, you know, appointments. And in the end, they looked to Dalglish. So it was a way of keeping him at the club, keeping that brain of his at the club, and to put him alongside, you know, the boot room staff that were there in place, and then to bring back Bob Paisley to work as a mentor. You know, we've spoken to Ian Herbert about, you know, his book Quiet Genius, and he downplayed the role that Paisley had in Dalglish's era of management and those first 2 years when he was basically assistant manager. I think at least on some level he'd have been a calming influence. And yes, Dalglish wanted to be his own manager and to implement his own plans and not just kind of like take Bob Paisley's view of it all. But he'd have felt the security of Paisley being there without a shadow of a doubt. So there was, again, this continuation. And it was an interesting schism as well because, you know, he wasn't Liverpool's most senior player at the time, Dalglish. Phil Neal was Liverpool's most senior player. And if a player was going to be appointed, Phil Neal felt that he would be the one. And he found difficulty in playing under Dalglish and having to view him as his manager, as the boss. To the point that, you know, by, I think it was the January or the February, he left for Bolton Wanderers to take up a player manager's role there, two divisions below, when he was still capable, although ageing, he was still capable of punching his weight in the first division. But Dalglish, he was a much underrated manager, certainly in that first spell. You know, he changed the Liverpool way of playing. What he did with that team he inherited was that he won the double with it that first season. A team that, you know, a squad that Alan Hansen declared to be at one point the worst he'd ever played in. And he was right when he said that, because Liverpool were misfiring for much of the first half of that season before they came on strong in the second half of the season. But then when Ian Rush was sold to Juventus, he didn't let the club absorb that blow that a lot of people felt was going to be a terminal blow to Liverpool. He completely altered the way that Liverpool played. And you know, you can't be, not to be a good manager, and be able to do that. You have to be a manager of substance to be able to alter the whole complexion and the playing pattern of the most successful team in England that had just won the double, you know, 12 months earlier, and say, right, what I'm going to do is kind of like just come up with a completely different idea of the way that Liverpool are playing. And that's what he did in 87-88. You know, they went from a team that played predominantly an attacking way through the middle, because what you had was Rush as the point on the end, Dalglish playing behind him. Others had done so, in likes of Paul Walsh. You know, you could look at Jan Molby and the balls that he would thread through. You had John Walk as well that was around for a while, that would play that similar game through the middle. You know, our wide midfielders weren't wingers, they were wide midfielders tucked in from Ray Kennedy and Jimmy Case, and then their successors were Ronnie Whelan and Sammy Lee. You know, Craig Johnston came along, which was, you know, the most closest resemblance to a natural winger we had, but without actually being a winger. You know, they would tuck in so that the fullbacks could overlap. But then Barnes came, and that changed everything. And when he signed John Barnes, that gave us an added width that we hadn't had for a decade, since Steve Highway had been in his peak years. And then to add Ray Houghton to that, and it stretched the field, and we didn't go through the middle constantly. And John Aldridge, while he looked like Ian Rush, he was a completely different entity. You know, Aldridge was a ball to feet in the penalty area kind of poacher, whereas Rush was kind of like, I want the ball, I want to run onto the ball and have longer period of time to think through how I'm going to finish. You know, you can look back at the YouTube goals of Ian Rush and then look back at the YouTube goals of John Aldridge. They look alike, but they didn't score alike. They were very, very different in the way that they scored the goals. And Aldridge was just basically a goal hanger. And that was what that team needed in 87-88. So to be able to have Beardsley behind it, Barnes to the left, you know, in essence, in theory, but Barnes was everywhere. And it was just a Liverpool team that played with this blizzard of attacking that stretched across the pitch in a way that we just haven't done for a decade at least.
It's funny, I mean, like I say, that the 87-88 team and that side, and obviously I wrote the article, and you're absolutely right, that the build-up play is just an absolute joy to watch. The goals, I'm not saying the goals are bang average, there's some great goals, but it's what happens leading up to the goal that is the sheer joy.
It is, I mean, and Brooke Sale, I've been lucky enough to read, you know, virtually all the articles in this magazine so far, and you touched on it, was the goal that Aldridge scored against Arsenal, and that was always one of my favourites from that season. There were so many other more spectacular finishes. I mean, he prods the ball in at the back post. Yeah, that's the finish, yeah. But that's where I'm coming across with Aldridge. Aldridge was that penalty box poacher. He was the man, you know, kind of like within that penalty area, prodding the ball into the back of the net. But he had an unerring knack, though, that I've never seen bettered, really, to have that unerring knack to know exactly where to be in the penalty area. And I'm not downplaying Aldridge and calling him a goal poacher, you know, and a goal hanger and a penalty. No, it's a very special player to have that instinct to know exactly where to position yourself, to have that split second to think the ball's going to roll across here, and to be there to put it in. You know, that is an act of genius within that. Yet that goal that Aldridge scored, it's all in the builder. And there's certain YouTube footage of it that only show it from McMahon keeping the ball in on the touchline. You need to find the footage that that has the build-up to the left-hand side where it's Steve Nicol. And people forget that Steve Nicol played the first half of that season predominantly as a left-back. And he linked, you know, telepathically with John Barnes down that left-hand side. And the interplay between the two to get into the corner flag before Barnes turns the Arsenal defender. And then it comes across the penalty area for McMahon to retrieve, to motor it back into the penalty area via Beardsley to Aldridge at the back post. It's just, I think, from that season, I don't think there's a single goal. Probably the Barnes goals against QPR. You know, they're my... Yeah, if my wife says what you're thinking about, it's usually John Barnes and goals against QPR in 87. You know, and that's just... But that's a team that Dalglish, you know, meticulously put together, and that's a year after winning the double. And then saying, right, Everton have won the title, Russia's gone, you know, we faded in the title race there. What I'm going to do now is this. You know, it would have been the easy, safer option to stick to what he knew. But he said, no, what I'm going to do is going to build this side. And then you're right, it played the most scintillating football I've ever seen a Liverpool side play, you know, up until... You know, the only comparable stuff for me is some of the stuff that Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool play. And I grew up on the 78-79 side. They were the omnipresent heroes when I, you know, became football coherent. And I grew up on those. And they were the most ruthless and focused and blindly attractive side as well. And they trumped the 87-88 side in so many ways, apart from the style of football in an aesthetically pleasing manner. You know, the 87-88 side just played this, you know, football that we've not seen before. I mean, you've got to consider it as, is that as a Liverpool fan of my age, of Jeff's age, of, you know, and I grew up listening to my dad's stories of the 60s and all of that, and we thought we'd seen it all. And I think I've written that in an article at some point, is that we thought we'd see it all, and then came Barnes on that 87-88
side. I mean, you know, guys, there's articles in there as well about Roy Evans, Houllier, Benitez, Klopp. I mean, you've got two European Cup winning managers that we've not even touched on yet. This is you know why, again, this is re-emphasising why we had to do a Liverpool magazine. But in terms of, I'm just going to leave the managers aside for now and sort of come to players. Now, in a second, Jeff, I'm going to get you to talk about John Barnes, because for me, again, as you know, Stephen said, for me, one of the best Liverpool players, certainly gave me the most joy as a Liverpool player watching Liverpool play. Stephen, I'm going to ask you to talk about Steven Gerrard, because again there is articles in the magazine about those two players as well, but obviously, Gary, you know, Xabi Alonso, you painted metaphorically almost the most beautiful picture, an analogy of Xabi Alonso, and he's maybe not a player that would immediately spring to mind, you know, and Jeff and Steven have mentioned loads of players, you know, whilst, you know, that are associated with different managers. But obviously, you know, you've gone with Xabi Alonso. So, you know, it's maybe not so much literally a left field choice. But why did you select him for your article?
I guess I said there was a little bit of selfishness because he's sort of my sort of footballer. But I think, you know, every successful team has a player like that. I mean, you know, there's going to Barcelona, you know, the Xavi at Barcelona. Certainly has a similar sort of aura about him, and you know, it's as I said earlier. You know, I understand it sounds a little bit trite to say, you know, he keeps a calm head when everybody else is running around like headless bloody chickens. But you know, it was almost that he had, and when he came to Liverpool, it would only be in his early 20s, 22 perhaps, when he came to Liverpool. And I did a little research about what he'd said about playing Liverpool, and he said, you know, he knew about the energy, the passion of the cup, but he said he didn't understand until he got there about the magic of Anfield. And you know, this is a guy who came from the Basque Country in Spain to Liverpool, and a total sort of culture shock, perhaps a new city, new culture, new team, almost new league, almost everything. But he still kept his Benitez bought him because he had the ability to play like he played, And it would be wrong to sacrifice that ability on the altar of the thud and blunder of Premier League or English top-tier football. And he didn't do that. He kept his way of playing. And it was a sort of... There's a cool maturity about his game that he kept possession. He played simple passes. He played complicated passes. He scored twice. From his own half of the park, you know, which is pretty impressive. Well, you know, to do it once, you can say, OK, you know, Rooney did it once and Beckham did it once. Xabi Alonso did it twice. So, you know, there's things like that. And then there's a famous game where he'd been injured. He broke his ankle. And I think it was a game against Chelsea. And he came back and it was quarter-final or semi-final of the European Cup and he played Juve away. And he wasn't fully fit. But he played, because there's a lot of other injuries. I think Gerrard was injured. And he played throughout that game a masterful performance, orchestrating the Liverpool midfield, just like a conductor, just, you know, easing the team through, the cool head. You know, it's almost like, you know, give it to Daddy, I'll look after it. Everything will be fine. And he got that ability about him. So that's why I wanted to write about Alonso, because not because he's, you know, the John Barnes guys who you mentioned earlier, who can, you know, magical runs through defences, and not the Rush or the Fowler or the Owen who scores lots of goals, but the quiet guy, the guy who gets the job done for you, the guy you can rely on, the guy you need, the guy every team needs.
I mean, do you think, Gary, and obviously... And I suppose, you know, we look at the Premiership now and it's incredibly fast-paced. The players are incredibly athletic. And yet, Xabi Alonso is not a player who, certainly for me, springs to mind as being the most athletic. But he certainly, you know, as you've just said, he's the sort of player that you would always want. You would always want him in your side.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes, you know, players are bored and asked to adapt. Well, you know, he didn't adapt. He made the game adapt to him. Because he had that ability. And, you know, if Xabi Alonso came into English football now, I mean, obviously, he'd be old now, but if he came in at 22 years old, as he was when he came to Liverpool all those years ago, then I still think we'd be just as effective, because it's that innate ability to not let the game rush by you, to control it, to keep in charge, to be, I say, that cool, that mature head around you. And it's a wonderful quality. And I'm, you know... compared him a few minutes ago to Xavi, you know, at Barcelona. That same ability to be the guy in the midfield. You give the ball to him and he finds a guy wearing the same colour shirt. And it's a massively underrated quality, but to do that with short passes, long passes, you know, two touch, one touch, control the ball, look around, you know, build up from the back, or it's a wonderful quality.
Obviously, you know, I'm going to come to you, Jeff, and, you know, as Gary mentioned there, it's, you know, John Barnes, Xabi Alonso are completely different players. They bring you two, you know, completely different elements of the game. They played in two different eras, but, you know, and like I say, I have, you know, a lot of respect for what Gary says about Xabi Alonso, you know, and discuss about how a team always needs him. But like I said at the beginning, for me, John Barnes is the player that for me, certainly in that 87, 88 season, all the time I was at Liverpool, got you off your seat. He is the sort of player that I would pay to watch. Xabi Alonso's the player I'd want in my side. John Barnes is the player that I would always pay money to go and watch.
Yeah, I mean, just memories of that season are just incredible. I mean, echo what Stephen said. You know, I thought I'd watched, you know, the greatest players and the greatest teams who'd ever graced Anfield. But that season was true. I mean, the word that keeps getting cropping up in articles about that season is flamboyance. They played with an arrogance, that side. And I think no one in that side epitomised that kind of arrogance and flair more than John Barnes did. He was the player that, you know, when he was on the ball, when he was, you know, tearing down the wing, when he was, you know, up against a defence, he was the one that would get your pulse racing. You would think that he could create something out of nothing. You know, he really was an incredibly exciting player. He was skillful with the ball, could score goals, was fast, could dribble, could go through defenders like they weren't there, and you know, was an incredibly exciting player. And I was fortunate enough to interview John Barnes a year or so ago. I was really interested in listening to him talk about the difference in culture between Watford and Liverpool, and I kind of almost expected him to say it was a step up in culture when he went to Liverpool. Liverpool had this huge scientific approach, and it was all very clever stuff and technically brilliant and all the rest of it. But he actually said the opposite. He said when he arrived at Anfield, he said it felt like it was primitive. He said it felt like it was really basic, and he kept waiting for game plans. He kept waiting to be told where to play, you know, how to line up on the pitch, you know, detailed conversations about the opposition, all of which Taylor had done at Watford, and he would tell them exactly every minute of the game. They'd be coached through every minute of the game at Watford, and obviously he'd had great success at Watford doing that. But when he came to Anfield, it was very much, you know, we've bought you because we think you've got a brain. We've bought you because you think you can work things out for yourself on the pitch. And he kind of slowly realised as his career at Anfield unfolded, that was the genius of, you know, that's why Liverpool was successful, because they chose the right players. So, you know, John Barnes was, you know, we can't not touch on, you know, the issue of race and the issue of race in Liverpool at the time. John Barnes wasn't Liverpool's first black player, but he was the first black player to be successful and break into the first team on a regular basis and all the rest of it. And, you know, he was able to win over sections of the fans. He was able to almost, I mean, I asked him this question, and he would say if he did anything, he made it less, you know, people felt less comfortable, you know, saying racist things during the match or shouting racist chants during the match, but he wouldn't say that he made racism go away at Anfield. But he actually changed it. I remember going to matches in the 70s and pre-John Barnes, and it wouldn't be uncommon to hear, you know, racist shouting at the match. John Barnes himself said, you know, he'd been racially abused by Liverpool fans when he was a Watford player. But that kind of went away when John Barnes came to play for Liverpool, and that, and he was quite clear about this. He said if I'd have been a rubbish player, it wouldn't have gone away. And you know, he in so many ways was a Liverpool player, you know, an archetypal Liverpool player, just someone with an amazing flair. You know, he you know, I've heard stories that he worked hard on the training pitch. I've heard stories that, you know, and he came from a fairly privileged background, relatively speaking. So he's not a kind of, not had a working class upbringing or anything like that. But because of his skill, because of his brain, because he, you know, worked hard for the team when he was on the pitch, and because of the actual massive contribution he made, he kind of won over huge swathes of Liverpool fans very, very quickly. He was one of the most exciting players I've ever watched.
I'm glad you agree, and I feel like I said, I've written the article on 87-88, and I was a bit wary of over exuberance and over celebration of the football. I wish I'd been a little bit more over the top. Now it's almost going to read as a slightly reserved opinion.
I'm not sure that we might be a pretty skewed bunch, me and Steve.
You know, Stephen, I come to you, and obviously, you know, you've written about Dalglish, but I've gone down the managerial route with your opinions on Dalglish. And I sort of want to come to Gerrard. Now, for me, you know, there's always polls, the greatest Premier League player, because some people, not us guys, obviously, but some people seem to think that football only started with the Premier League. In the Premier League era, they talk about Henry and Bergkamp, but for me, Gerrard is the best Premier League player, or the best player of the Premier League era. I thought he had absolutely everything. Not counting so much maybe international football, but at club football, he for me has been the greatest player in the Premier League, bar none. And again, as Jeff just mentioned, I get this might be a skewed opinion from you, but what is, you know, a one club player? You know, what was Steven Gerrard to Liverpool Football Club?
Steven Gerrard kind of like pulled Liverpool through so many times. He was like a modern day Billy Liddle. You know, listen to Liverpool fans of a certain era that, you know, will still swear blind that Billy Liddle's the greatest player they ever saw in a Liverpool shirt, and he was a player that, you know, he won the league title with Liverpool in the late 1940s, got to an FA Cup final, and then Liverpool kind of like went off a cliff edge, relegation in 54, as Gary said, they didn't come back till 62, by which time Liddle had retired. But during those second division days, you know, Liddle could have left the club could have you know, come to an agreement to leave the club to go back into the First Division. Didn't, stayed with the club, and to the point that, you know, there were times when Liverpool were referred to as Liverpool because he was the one shining beacon, really, in a sea of mediocrity. And while the Liverpool of the Premier League era didn't quite descend to those kind of dips, there were some dark days, and having a player like Steven Gerrard, that, you know, because when you're part of a team that's been successful and your focus is on winning trophies, what can you win at the end of the season? And when they stop kind of doing that, then you narrow your focus down to individual games, and it's about the small victories. All of a sudden, it's just about winning, you know, the next game. And if you lose the next one, then it's about winning the one after that. You know, so when you're on top of the world, as Liverpool, you know, seemingly are at the minute, then yes, it's about the bigger picture, and it's about what can they win. You know, and Manchester United fans will recognise this, and fans of any big club or club that's won trophies on a regular basis at some point in the lifetime will recognise that. It comes down to the bad seasons. It's about small victories, about individual games. And that's what Gerrard did. Gerrard dragged Liverpool through some poor eras and some poor seasons. But it would swing to the opposite end of the spectrum, where there was a Champions League that he won, there was an FA Cup final that bears his name, and he was just metronomic, you know, and he was just a stunning all-round player. You know, I watched his, and I was there for his debut, I was there for his final game, you know, and it was a privilege to be able to watch the entire span of his career, you know, in so many of those grounds that he graced. And you know, it was the style of football and what he could do. And I can remember very early in his career, very, very early. We're probably talking, you know, 98, 99, when Liverpool were pretty abject. And I can remember being sat in the main stand and an older voice, you know, from behind me saying he's the closest thing that he'd see to Duncan Edwards. And I, you know, knew of Duncan Edwards. I knew, you know, the connotations of Duncan Edwards and all the legend of Duncan Edwards. Never seen footage of him playing, you know, but I knew that it was a substantial kind of compliment for someone to be making. And that never left. You know, it was always stuck in the back of the mind. And, you know, is there any better compliment to be able to make in comparison to another British footballer?
You're right. I thought, you know, he was, you know, I would liken him almost to Roy of the Rovers. You know, sometimes the feats that he seemed to achieve were superhuman.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that, you know, it was that vision and those span of passes, you know, and the fact that it's kind of like passion and emotion were grafted to that as well, which is an impossible balance in that, really. You know, you either have one or the other. You know, the players who are full-blooded and passionate, but they will, you know, lack that, you know, utter unbottleable skill, basically. You know, he came through and he played brilliantly at right back in his early days. You know, he played a few games in midfield, but then, you know, the first half season that he played as a first team regular, he played games at right back, and, you know, he looked like the best right back in the country at like 19. You know, to the point that I can remember Tommy Smith writing an article in Liverpool Echo saying that he should stick a right back and be England's right back for kind of like decades to come. But, you know, he was this midfield, you know, you couldn't have Steven Gerrard. I mean, in a way, it's like Trent Alexander-Arnold. Now people are talking about him being a central midfielder. You know, it's that leap of faith of saying, yeah, he could play that position, but what we will do, we will shift into where we think he could be one of the best in the world. And I'm not saying he's not the best in the world at right back now, or one of the best in the world at right back, but what if he can be an even better central midfielder? And that was kind of like the decision that Gerard Houllier had to make, is that, yes, there's this player who's been very, very, very good at right back, but what we really need him is eventually to be a midfielder. And he gradually got there because he played on the right-hand side of midfield. He used to swing in the most beautiful crosses from the right-hand side of midfield. And then eventually he settled on his, you know, his position. But even then, you know, even from the central midfield days, you know, under Benitez, he played as the split striker almost. You know, we played a 4-4-1 formation, and he was the one that played behind Fernando Torres as the point. So, you know, he eventually graduated to this role of what was the Kenny Dalglish role, basically, you know, occupied by, you know, Peter Beardsley, Paul Walsh, you know, these wonderfully enigmatic ball players. And that was the thing about Gerrard. He had this running scope of being able to play absolutely anywhere. And I swore blind that he could have dropped into central defence. You know, I think a trick was missed. You know, it was something that happened with Emlyn Hughes in the 70s that he was this central midfielder. He played a lot of football early at left back. He moved into the central midfield, and then kind of like when Liverpool went ball playing central defenders, mid 1970s, Emlyn Hughes dropped back into central defence, and I think that was something that Gerrard could have carried off. You know, in his later years, we might have actually, instead of him going to America, I think we could have got an extra couple of years out of him as a centre-back. You know, Liverpool central defence of Carragher and Gerrard would have been an interesting experiment to have made.
I feel, obviously, you know, we've got countless players we've not looked at. You know, we've not looked at Keegan, Ian Rush, you know, Jess Ridge, Robbie Fowler, Michael Owen. So, you know, we've missed out on so many players, and there's still bits to talk about. But I want us to come to the European Cups, which, again, as a part-time fan of Hull City, obviously fascinates me, and where I'll never get anywhere near. Jeff, I'm gonna ask you about 2005, and Stephen, I'm gonna ask you about the sort of the latest Champions League success of last season. But Gary, you know, you mentioned right at the start about, you know, Liverpool's seeming inevitable dominance, if you like, in those late 70s, early 80s. It's four European Cup wins in eight seasons. And, you know, it's difficult to, you know, apart from maybe relatively recently Real Madrid, but it's almost difficult to comprehend Liverpool's total dominance in European football.
It is, you know, from anybody who is sort of, you know, the younger generation, you know, and you know, as a non-Liverpool fan, I have no problem saying, you know, this is, you know, if not the, certainly one of the couple of, you know, best teams of all, clubs of all time in this football. But, and, you know, it seems strange for that a club that hasn't won the English Championship for the best part of, I think it's exactly 30 years, I think, if I'm serves me right. You know, in the same time where they haven't won it, you know, United won it 12 times, my club won it 5 times, and Arsenal won it 4 times, and Liverpool didn't. But you need to understand the history as well. And, you know, the times when Liverpool dominated European football, you know, teams were beaten before they went out at Anfield. You know, and I have no doubt about that. You know, even some of the biggest teams, and you know, of late, you know, they had the Barcelona collapse against Liverpool recently. But that used to happen on a fairly regular basis, you know, under the lights at Anfield on a European night. And when Liverpool dominated European football, teams were beaten, you know. And when Liverpool won the European Cup, you know, say, 4 times in 8 years, they didn't beat Mickey Mouse teams. They were beating teams who were the champions of their country. It wasn't people who finished third or fourth and, you know, got in because, you know, they finished 17 points behind the team that won the league. They were all league champions, so there was no gimmies there. And that's the year, when I mentioned earlier that, you know, I remember Liverpool being, you know, a dominant team. That's the year I'm talking about. And Liverpool seemed to almost have a monopoly on buying the best players. Everybody wanted to play for Liverpool because you almost guaranteed trophies. You were guaranteed European football. You were almost guaranteed the European Cup, you know. Four successes in 8 years, you know. I mean, other than Real Madrid in the early years, and I know Ajax won it 3 times, the bounce, and so did Bayern Munich. But over that 8 years, the dominance of Liverpool European football was immense, absolutely immense. They didn't dominate English football, they dominated European football. And as I say, teams were beaten before they used to take to the field at Anfield.
We'll come to, like you say, we will mention fan culture and Anfield and the support and that sort of thing there. But I think you're right, Gary. It was almost, you know, certainly from me as a, you know, growing up, it was almost an air of inevitability that Liverpool would be European champions.
It absolutely was. And, you know, the teams that beat, so they, the emerging talents of Mönchengladbach. They beat Bruges when Bruges were a more than decent side. They beat Real Madrid. They beat Roma. You know, these weren't topping out your teams that they beat, and they dominated teams. I remember particularly the Mönchengladbach final, and I think if I'm right, Terry McDermott scored the first goal, and Tommy Smith scored. I can't remember who scored the other one, but Mönchengladbach were a real classy team as well. It was a real cracking game of football, but Liverpool dominated them because other teams didn't feel Liverpool, but they almost did. They had a certain trepidation because they had this aura about them. People say Gary Lineker has this thing, you know, football's a game of 11 between 11 and 11 for 90 minutes, and in the end Germany win. Well, at the European football in those days, it was a game of 11 for 11, you know, 90 minutes, and in the end Liverpool win, because that's just what happens so regularly.
Brilliant. What a great analogy, Gary. Jeff, obviously, you know, 2005, but before I get your opinion on 2005, there is an article in the magazine. It's actually an interview with Jamie Carragher, and Stephen and I were lucky enough to interview him. And, you know, we couldn't let the opportunity pass without asking him about half-time in Istanbul and what was said and what happened in those 15 minutes. And this is what he had to say about it.
The half-time dressing room in Istanbul and Benitez, I mean, what, you know, there's lots of hearsay and this was said and that was said, but ultimately, you know, what do you remember the clear message from Benitez at half-time?
Well, it wasn't that clear a message. I mean, his English wasn't amazing really in his first season. You think he'd get his message across, but it wasn't just off the, you know, it wouldn't just flow, and it wasn't just off the cuff, and you could get emotional and stuff like that. It was a bit chaotic, to be honest. Really, when we got back in the dressing room, you know, everyone's playing the biggest game of their lives, everyone's heads in their hands, really, you think it's over, and you've got a manager who is you know, Spaniard, really, and Rafa Benitez is not a motivator. He's someone who can change games tactically, but he's not certainly going to lift everyone in the dressing room. It's just not his way, really. Jared Fuller is more of a motivator, but Rafa probably knew more about the game to change things tactically. And the first thing he did, he told Jimmy Traore to go and get a shower. Because his English wasn't that great, he'd keep it as basic as possible. So rather than explaining to someone why they were coming off at half time and the change he was going to make, he just said shower. So he just said Traore shower. And that's what he was. So very blunt. Next thing, Steve Finnan and the physio are having a debate. Finnan thinks he can carry on, the physio doesn't think he'll last for the second half. Benitez then gets told this and thinks, oh my God, I've just brought Jimmy Traore off. And don't forget, I've already used one sub in the first half in Harry Kewell and Schmeisser. So yeah. Harry Kewell coming off, Schmeisser going on. So then he tells Traore to get out the shower. Finnan goes in the shower. And then we change to sort of three at the back. Didier Mann comes back in because he's been out warming up. He's coming off for Finnan. And don't forget, this is all happening within 15 minutes. Then Rafa has to then put them, you know, on the board and write what we're going to do. He actually put 12 men on. He put Julian Cissé on there as well, also, for whatever reason. I don't know if Cissé had his kit off or if, you know, his tattoo top off. And he was in, you know, the corner of his eye. So that was like, he brought a little smile to our faces even at half time. To be honest, in some ways, that's what I can remember from it. And sometimes you're not quite sure if it did really happen. You know, sometimes you feel if you want to go back and actually, what did actually happen in this 15 minutes? I mean, those things happened, but I'm sure there was a lot more. I'm not sure what conversations I was having with Steve or the players or other people, how they were reacting. Because, I mean, it's just a blur in some ways. But it was chaotic and it wasn't a normal 15 minutes. But listen, it all adds to the, you know, the miracle of Istanbul.
Yeah, absolutely, without a doubt. And you can imagine, like I say, it's always that moment in sport, and obviously you had two halves, plus you had extra time, but for me, it's that 15 minutes, and like you say, no one will ever really know what was said or what happened. People will have different memories and different perspectives, but for me, that 15 minutes is the real bit that fascinates me about that whole game.
Yeah, but I mean, as I said, if your half time was like that every week, you'd be saying, well, half time's not great, it's not going exactly where we want it. But it's good that we've actually got Rafa Benitez, fingers crossed, coming on Monday Night Football in a couple of weeks. So it's obviously something to ask him. I know I was there, but what was his? Everyone has their own way of seeing things, of how that half time went. I mean, Jabeel Cisse believed that Steven Gerrard did the team talk and Rafa Benitez was sent outside. I read he said that somewhere a year ago, which was just absolute nonsense. So everyone has their own way. So maybe that did happen and I didn't see that, but so maybe everyone's got their own. Memory of that situation. But it'll be interesting today, Rafa's side of it.
Absolutely.
And how he sort of dealt with it when we get him on Monday night.
So, obviously, Stephen and I were hanging on every word with what he said there. But Jeff, for you, 2005, is it the greatest European Cup final?
Yes, absolutely it is, yeah. I mean, the 77 final, the early finals, the 77 final was a good final, as Gary said. The game against Bruges in 78 was not a great game. The game against Real Madrid, not a fantastic game. And in 84, that went to penalties. So you had the kind of drama of penalties in 84. But if you were to write a movie about a plucky underdog, playing arguably the best team in Europe at the time, having not won the European Cup and for 30 years, 1984 to 2000, my maths is no good, but they haven't won it for a long time. And you should write a movie about it. You couldn't have written the script any better. 3-0 down, seemingly not a hope in hell at half time, and then as we've just heard from Jamie there, something miraculous happens at half time. And the game changes, and it changes in 6 minutes, three goals in 6 minutes, and it's, utterly incredible. And I thought, one of the best things LFC did when they produced their season video, the Champions League video, is they had the first half in black and white and the second half in colour, and you couldn't get, a better metaphor for that final. But then you have so many great characters in that game as well. So you have, obviously, there's the sublime skill and class of Milan. You've got Ancelotti on the touchline, who's a great manager in European football. Milan are an absolutely fantastic team, cultured team, brilliant team. But then in Liverpool's team, you've got, hard as nails, Jamie Carragher, who can also play football, a local lad. You've got Steven Gerrard in midfield, arguably, but played in three or four different positions in that game. And Jerzy Dudek in goal, who pulls off what is an utterly impossible save against Shevchenko late on, and then his antics on the touchline emulate Grobbelaar in 84. I mean, it has everything, that fan. It has fans leaving, small number of fans leaving the stadium, and then hearing that we've pulled it back to 3-all in the taxi on the way back to the bar, and then trying to get back into the stadium. You've got the scenes at home in Liverpool with people having these internal debates about whether to switch it off at half-time and put a film on or stick it out. You've got loved ones and family members sent out into the back garden at half-time, then not allowed back in case they jinx it, because while they were outside, Liverpool scored. I mean, it's just endless stories about that final. And, of course, it resurrected Liverpool, didn't it? Because we'd gone so long. We'd had that kind of... we'd had that period under Houllier in 2001 where we'd won five trophies in a calendar year, but then his sort of reign had sort of dissipated, and then Benitez comes in. This is a fairly average season, let's be honest. In the league, we finished fifth behind Everton. We were not really setting the world on fire in the group. In fact, it went to the last game of the group against Olympiacos, and then Rivaldo scored in the first half for Olympiacos, which meant we had to score three in the second half. And for me, that's when the season erupted, in the second half against Olympiacos at Anfield. I was in the Anfield Road End that night, and the Olympiacos fans were celebrating at half-time as if they were already through. Liverpool were going to be in the UEFA Cup. And then something happened at Anfield. And I think from that moment, I really became convinced that Liverpool would make it to the final. In fact, I went out and did something I never do, which is to bet on Liverpool, because I'm normally the kiss of death. But I went out and put money on Liverpool to win the European Cup. And so from that moment on, you know, Liverpool beat Leverkusen. They get a draw at Juventus, and after beating them at Anfield with that absolutely sublime Luis Garcia goal. And then the semi-final against, sorry, Gary, the semi-final against Chelsea, until the last 10 minutes against Barcelona last season in the semi-final against Barcelona, was perhaps the most tense I've ever been at a football match, because we scored very early on in the game and then had to go 90-odd minutes of trying to hold on to that lead. And good Johnson...
Is that the one where the ball didn't go off the line, Jim?
I still find it was touching the back of the neck. and then when the ball falls to Good Johnson after death, and you know, it just has goal written all over it, but somehow it didn't go in. And send that roar of full time when the referee blows the whistle is one of the most deafening noises I've ever heard. And that's kind of signalling that Liverpool are back. You know, Liverpool are back on the big stage once more, a European Cup final. Europe means so much to Liverpool supporters. I'd even argue it's very close. I mean, we want to win the Premier League because we haven't won it for 30 years. We're desperate to win it. But give me a European Cup final every time. You know, give me a game against Europe's best and Anfield under the floodlights, and nothing compares to it. And then we ended that campaign, didn't we? Absolutely the best European Cup final we've ever played.
Great Liverpool were, and Jeff said, Liverpool were the underdogs, and they absolutely were. Just to underscore that, on form, Liverpool were not only nowhere near the best club in Europe, they weren't even the best club in Liverpool, because they finished behind Everton in the league. So, it's a total threat. Where Jeff says, they were the underdogs massively.
Stephen, listening to what. To what Jeff's, it's a good job you're on this, Gary. To listen to what Jeff just said there, about wanting to win the European Cup, it becoming a habit. And I suppose, there's the defeat to Madrid, two seasons ago. There's the victory against Tottenham last season. You're looking not comfortable, but you would argue that, potentially another Champions League final. Is this the start of another Liverpool dynasty in Europe?
It could be. It's to reach one Champions League finals, a hell of a task to do it 2 years running, and not just that, but to come back from the manner of defeat, 12 months earlier, to go out and win it the following season. But even then, it was always won off the cuff. Or in a certain manner, anyway, because we weren't great in the group stages. I think we lost all three. Did we lose all three group games? Yeah. Otherwise, I think we did. We lost all three away group games last season and then won all the home games. It wasn't a scintillating group stage, but that mirrored 2005 in that respect. But then from the knockout stages onwards, we were just properly on it. That win against Bayern Munich in the Allianz was amazing. That goal where Mane kind of like turns 360 degrees. I mean, that's the great thing about watching this Liverpool at the minute, is that they just do gravity-defying things. You watch them and think, you're not meant to go that way. You're not meant to turn that way. You're not meant to play that ball. Yet they do it. And it's just a joy to watch. And yes, they do look like a team that could dominate for some time to come.
Like I say, Stephen, the champions that, you and I have discussed this, and, winning, and Gary's mentioned it there, winning the European Cup, when it was the European Cup, you were always playing against the league winners of other seasons. You've mentioned before, yeah, the qualifying competition is 38 games just to get into the tournament.
Yeah, well, 42 back then. So, yeah. To win your league title was your qualifying section to get into the tournament. And then once you were into the European Cup, then, you were on a tightrope. One false move and you were down. And Liverpool proved that by in kind of like 78, 79 when they lost to Forest at the first hurdle and then Dinamo Tbilisi the following year. So, you know, you could have made that. And if you did make that kind of like fatal early error, then, you know, you have to win your league title to get back into it for the following season. So, you know, it was for, you know, the cream of Europe in that respect is that, you know, it was on that higher kind of plateau. And there wasn't like a huge gap down to kind of the UEFA Cup and the Cup Winners' Cup. They were still huge tournaments, but there was this kind of like elevated plateau for the European Cup because of what you had to go through to get there. And Gary's right, some of the teams that Liverpool played to get to those and win those European Cups were phenomenal. You know, he rattled off so many of them, but I'd add another one in Saint-Étienne, you know, in 77 in the quarterfinals. And the interesting thing about them and Borussia Mönchengladbach, not just the 77 final, but the 78 semi-final. And that was the same Bayern Munich in the 81 semi-final. So, you know, they're tripping off the mind again, and there they are. But what Liverpool had in those respects was that mirror image to kind of like last season's win, but in a different manner, because, yes, it's the Champions League, and it's that era where there's four teams allowed into it. You know, it's got to a point now where you are champions of Europe, but it's a completely different way of becoming champions of Europe. But one of the mirror images for me last season was that the final wasn't where it was won. It was won in the semi-final. And you can point to that in kind of like 78. You know, Bruges were a very, very good side. And it's an understated final, really. I mean, I've sat and watched that, and it's not as bad as people remember it to be. You know, Liverpool could have won that by a couple more. They could have had, you know, it could have been a 3 or a 4-0 win. And if it was, then it would have been looked at as a masterclass in the way that, you know, Liverpool against Newcastle are in that era, the 1974 FA Cup final. You know, the result needs to be more one side to do the performance justice, whereas in 81 it was an abject final on a very poor pitch that was won by, you know, one moment of decisiveness. But yeah, last season was that Barcelona game where it was won.
I just want to, before we come on to sort of the last question that I want to ask you all, I don't mind Jeff or Stephen can answer this. Does it, and again, I can't believe I'm asking this question, but does it feel different winning the European Cup having not won your league?
I think for me, it's, I can detach the two eras. You know, they are two completely different eras. You know, winning the Champions League, I mean, I'm to compare that, you know, it's the comparison of being European champions as league winners, but watching it through your child's eyes. Whereas now as a grown-up, and I'm watching it, and yes, I can be cynical about the tournaments, and I can be, you know, condescending about the tournaments, you know, and the way that it is created and the way that it has been manipulated. But I think for me, I can see a switch off from kind of like the last 16 becomes electrifying. You know, once that group stage is finished, it suddenly becomes the European Cup of old.
Yeah.
And I, when I was bouncing around in Madrid celebrating it, no, it didn't feel any less than it did before. But in the cold light of day, I can still say that the old currency feels better than the new currency.
Okay. So one last.
Can I just add something there, Steve?
Yeah,
move on.
And
we've had this sort of conversation before, Steve, you and myself. And yeah, you know, I absolutely agree with what Steve says about, you know, the quality in the, you know, the early competition when it was, you know, it was the 38 or 40 odd game, whichever league you were playing in to qualify. But, you know, winning a tournament where there's one team from Spain, one team from Germany, one team from Italy, compared to, you know, the four best teams in Spain, the four best teams in Italy, the four best teams in England, the four best teams in Germany, it might be a little bit more difficult to win it, strange enough, in the modern era.
It can be. I think there's swings and roundabouts there. Yeah, I mean, you do have more scope for kind of like error in the early rounds. You know, like I say, Liverpool won 3 and lost 3 to get through. I mean, was it Spurs last season where they did they not win a game until like the 5th game or something?
Possibly.
You know, I can remember Liverpool going through one year from one group with one win, where we'd won one, drawn four, and lost one, and it was like 7 points, and it was enough to sneak through. And there was something massively unsatisfactory about that, you know. And that was where you had that Russian roulette element to the old style European Cup, where yes, Forest, we blew it. Yes, we played Dinner to Police the following year, and we got it wrong, and we blew it again. Go back to the drawing board, win your own league title to get back into it again. So there was that kind of, like, you know, that was difficult to do. But at the same time, it's still difficult to do now because, you know, I can't even remember off the top of my head who we played in the quarterfinal last season. But to have to go through Bayern Munich and Barcelona to get to the final was, you know, and we're talking kind of like an omnipresent Bayern Munich who had been poor for the first half of the season by their high standards, yet clicked into form by the time we faced them. And then that Barcelona and Lionel Messi, for God's sake, and stuff like that. So, you know, and that's the thing, because of those two performances, I go completely blank. Who did we play in the quarterfinal last season, Jeff?
In the quarters? God.
I want you experts on. I can't believe we've got you two on. We need someone else.
Those two performances were just so, you know, awe-inspiring that it completely blitzed who was in the quarterfinal. And then the Tottenham
Porto.
Game.
Porto.
There you go, with Porto. But, I mean, it's you know, no disrespect to Tottenham. And I think had the game been better, you know, and it'll be, you know, an understated classic in years to come. It was a chess-playing classic. If that was a Juventus versus Milan final from 15 years ago at Old Trafford or whenever it was, then people would have been drooling over it, you know, and you know, I'll look back at that game more, you know, with a different aspect, I think, in years to come. Yeah. But yeah, you know, it was blown away by the semi-finals.
Yeah.
Before, I suppose, you know, as always, time goes against us, and you know, I'm pretty sure we've done, you know, or certainly you guys have done justice to the fact that this Liverpool magazine was needed. But I think just before we go, sort of just briefly, I just want to touch on Anfield, or you know, and you can interpret this however you want. You know, the three of you, I don't mind. They're all, the question is pretty much going to be the same, and you know, and what does Anfield mean? You know, as a club, you know, we have these new stadiums, these identikit stadiums, but you know, you have Anfield, and to me, it seems a, you know, an incredibly special place. And you know, Stephen and Jeff, you two guys get to sit there every couple of Saturdays or Wednesday nights, whenever it is, to enjoy the games. But what does it mean? And I suppose, Gary, as a Chelsea fan, it's a little bit different. You know, the answer will be a bit different and a bit more difficult, perhaps, for you, but. But for you, Gary, what does Anfield mean to you?
I want to answer this in sort of perhaps a way that you may not have intended. What Anfield means now, what Anfield meant in the last 20-odd years and what it meant before that, I think are different things.
Brilliant.
The word Liverpool playing now is not dissimilar in some ways to the Liverpool dominating when they were winning all those European trophies. I remember that when the Liverpool used to play in those days, they dominated teams. They were like waves of attack coming over and washing over the opposition and inevitably washing them away. And they've got that aura back. I won't say a little bit, but you know, a fair bit. They've got their aura back now when teams are really struggling, even before they kick a ball now. So I think Anfield has taken on the aura that it had, you know, 35 years ago, perhaps. And it's, you know, everybody says, oh, you know, our ground's a fortress and all that sort of thing. I remember when Marina was at Chelsea, we never lost a home game for, I think, 2.5 years or something like that. But, you know, Liverpool, this season, I think, have won every league game bar one, and they drew that. And, you know, Man City set a punch record last season. And Liverpool, I won't say could, but are likely to break that this season. So I think what Anfield is what it was once 30 years ago.
Brilliant, Gary. Great start.
Thank you.
No, you're brilliant. Jeff, for you, lifelong Liverpool fan, you know, what does Anfield mean to you?
Well, this is where I risk gushing and really annoying the non-Liverpool supporters who are listening to this, really. So.
Oh, they've switched off ages ago. Don't worry about them.
I mean, So, I agree completely with Gary. Anfield's gone through many transitions. So, the 90s was not a great time in my opinion, to go to Anfield regularly. Certainly wasn't like it was in the 70s and 80s. Sort of the advent of all-seater stadiums has definitely had an impact on the atmosphere at Anfield. But for people like myself, I guess, who've grown up in the city and grown up very close to Anfield, within walking distance from Anfield, Anfield's much more than that. It feels much more than that. It's you know, when you go into Anfield, when you've been going as long as I have, and I'm sure Stephen would say the same, you're kind of surrounded by ghosts, aren't you? You're surrounded by ghosts of old games. You're surrounded by ghosts of old mates who went with your songs you used to sing. Atmospheres you can still feel, smells. Stories, you know, shouts that people, you know, people come out with the most hilarious things of football. And it's maybe the same for other teams. I'm sure it is. But, you know, you hear chants, you hear spontaneous songs being started, and, you know, they all come back. And there is some... I'm not a religious person at all. The closest thing I come to religion is football. And there is... I think I've said this before to you guys. I think there is something about being in one place with tens of thousands of people who all believe and all think and all want the same thing as you. In the 70s and 80s, that manifested itself in the most magical culture I've ever experienced. Spontaneous wit, songs, the noise, the anthems, the colours, the flags, the banners, you know, that it was all about that. And that's still carry that with me now. Even in recent years, when the atmosphere has not been great and people have been grumbling and moaning and getting nervous during games, you know, I carry all that legacy, all that history with me when I go to Anfield. And, you know, the feeling of being around the place on a match day, you know, being in the pub, chatting to your mates, walking down Walton Breck Road towards the cup, there is something, there's something magical about it. And then still now, even though we... You know, it's not what it was in the 70s. I have to say, it's not what it was in the 70s in terms of the, you know, the noise and you know, the particularly unique culture that there was back then. There are moments, and increasingly more so now under Klopp, those moments have become much more frequent. But there have always been moments at Anfield, even during the lean periods, where the place comes alive, and you can just tell that it's had an effect on our players, but it's had an even bigger effect on theirs. And you know, and so for me, it's a spiritual place, spiritual in the smallest. It represents family history. It represents it's who I am, and it's part of me, part of my DNA, really.
Like. What a brilliant answer, Stephen. I'm really sorry you've got to follow that. You've now got to sum up something completely different, please, about what Anfield means to you. It's fine. You can say what you want.
Jeff's absolutely nailed it there. Speaks, you know, so many of my sentiments. Is that there's just something about the place that's almost intangible. You know, it's something. Days it can be absolutely silent and a soulless place sometimes, but other days, you know, especially the games under the floodlights, the European nights, where there's just some kind of you know, manic magic at play. And that Barcelona game last season was the pinnacle of it. I've seen some special nights, but that blew everything that I think I've seen away. And it is almost like some kind of puppetry at play. When it's like that, you know, I think I got to my seat. You know, I'd been on the concourse watching whatever was on the television. I was having a pre-match drink, and then, you know, you're up into your seat, and obviously everyone's standing up anyway, and suddenly just it's almost like a switch, and it's, you know, it is almost indescribable when that happens, and it's an electrical charge almost. And it does feel like, you know, an out-of-body experience almost on those most prominent nights like Barcelona's. It's home. It's home, you know.
It's a great way to finish, fellas. You know, Anfield is home, and you know, for you two, you know, for you two guys, it certainly is, and hopefully for the sort of hundreds of thousands, millions of Liverpool supporters, you know, around the world. I won't say we'll get millions of listeners, but certainly, you know, I'm sure, you know, I'm sure people echo your thoughts. Hopefully, you know, this podcast has given everyone a taste. You know, for what's in store with the magazine. It's, you know, it sounds like a crass selling pitch, but that's not it. It's a chance to, you know, this conversation was a chance to celebrate Liverpool Football Club. The magazine is done because, you know, Stephen said at the beginning, it needed doing. There was a lot of thinking about it, but I think all of us at These Football Times realised that, you know, that this magazine, that, you know, Liverpool Football Club was the right club at the right time for this magazine. And like I say, as a fan of football, it's been an absolute sort of pleasure to listen to all three of you talk about the club. I think everything that you've said, people will be able to relate to it. Certainly, you know, fans of football, and we talk about fans of football rather than football fans. I think, you know, they'll all be able to relate to this. And it's, like I say, hopefully it will come across in the magazine, but it's certainly come across in this podcast, you know, this last hour and a bit, you know, listening to you guys. It's been absolutely brilliant. Jeff, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it. I loved it.
Brilliant. Gary, thank you for keeping me company as someone who got to sit and listen to two Liverpool fans talk about their club.
I think we sort of touched on the subject earlier, the key word earlier, and that's respect. And, you know, and if you're a football fan, you haven't got respect for Liverpool Football Club, you weren't really a true football fan.
I agreed. I absolutely agree. Stephen, you know, it was going to happen one day. It was destiny that we would spend the best part of an hour and a half on a Thursday night chatting about purely about your club.
If you scan the small print of my contract, it's in there somewhere.
like I say, gents, it's been an absolute pleasure. You know, please, you know, everybody who's listened to this, please, there's not long left to purchase it. Please make sure you get a copy of it. And like Stephen said at the beginning, once it's gone, it's gone. Or you're paying three times the price on eBay and there's no magazine smell either. It's a lose-lose. Thank you guys for taking part. And all that's left for me is to say thank you to the listeners. And please join us again next time on the Lob podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.